right. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Glad to see everyone, even though we're all two-dimensional instead of three, as we'd really like to be. I'm glad that you were able to join us this afternoon. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting and important hearing that we have on tap for you. So as we get started, I just would like to give you a bit of an orientation about this hearing. As you all know, the pandemic is continuing to wreak havoc on people all over the world. And here in the U.S. and in Minnesota, we are really in crisis. All of us are experiencing the pandemic to one degree or another. And I don't need to lay this out for you. It has so many impacts on all of us. But the people who are working on the front lines of healthcare are having this experience in a very different way than most of us. They are seeing this firsthand, and they are understanding this impact in a way that the rest of us really are not. And so the attempt that we're making here today is to give the public more of a window into what is really going on, because we're in a situation where we need everyone's help. We need to really come together and fight this pandemic together. And so it's really important for us to hear from the people on the front lines. We're going to start today hearing from Commissioner Malcolm with an update on COVID in Minnesota. And the members have been mailed out the presentation slides, which she will be working off of today. We will have a chance to ask some questions, but the purpose of this hearing today is really mostly to focus on the firsthand experience of the people who are living this day in and day out and seeing the real, real impact. And just to be clear, when this is not everybody who's seeing it, there are many people who are working at the front lines who we're not going to be hearing from today. We're just hearing from some nurses, some physicians. We're not hearing from other categories of people who are equally important and equally impacted, EMTs, respiratory therapists, everyone who is touching this personally, I know is, our hearts are going out to all of you. And we're just going to be hearing a very few of those stories today. So with that, first, I would like to turn this over to Commissioner Malcolm to give us a walkthrough. And as we do that, I first want to just thank the commissioner and her whole department. You know, the Department of Health is a really small agency comparatively, and they have been just working day and night over all these many months and now years to do the very best for Minnesotans. So thank you, Commissioner, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling. It is always an honor to be with you and the committee. And thank you for that acknowledgement of the work of MDH. And I would just like to say the same certainly goes for our colleagues in local public health departments who are also very much on the front lines. And I appreciate your framing of this. We are indeed in a crisis moment with the differences in Omicron. And the crisis is really most acutely felt, of course, in workforce shortages that are beginning to pop up all over the place and in our healthcare capacity. These slides, some of them, if for those of you who've been able to join us on our every other week legislator briefings, you have seen before, you have them. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. I think it is highly appropriate that you hear, you spend most of your time today talking with frontline caregivers. So I'll just really go quickly through these, and I'll stay on as long as I can. Others on my team are on the call if you do have questions right after this presentation or later in the hearing if there's time, and you can always reach us directly as well. So these first couple slides, this is how we feel. Probably the public does too, but we sort of feel in some ways like we're back at the beginning of this, just in terms of the uncertainty of what's going to happen next. On the other hand, we certainly have a lot more tools in our toolbox to deal with this now. And while this is very serious, the other key message that I want to just continue to share with you is that we're not powerless against this. We have tools. We, as individuals and communities, there are things we can do to assist in getting through these next critical weeks. Next slide, please. What we know about Omicron, and you probably all have read plenty about this at this point in time, it is incredibly infectious, so much more easily spread than the earlier strains of SARS-CoV-2. Cases double in cities around the world, and we're starting to see it here, literally double every 1.5 to 3 days. That is a speed of growth that we've not seen with any previous variants. The better news is we do see the evidence continues to kind of build that a reduced proportion of people infected with the Omicron variant experience severe disease. And Omicron is producing symptomatic disease, but milder in persons who are immunized either by vaccination or prior infection. The reason that Omicron appears to be milder for many people, not all to be sure, is that the Omicron tends to focus in the upper respiratory tract and not get as deeply down into the lungs as Delta and prior strains have. The next slide describes that this, what we're seeing in terms of all these breakthrough infections, and I'm sure you're hearing about it, perhaps experiencing it, but large numbers of breakthrough infections among those who have been fully vaccinated, even boosted, and a very large number of reinfections, people who previously had COVID, but are now being reinfected with the Omicron variant. This is a partial vaccine or partial immunity escape variant, that it is, gets past the defenses against infection in particular to a much greater degree than the earlier strains. Boosters do increase the immune response, but not to the same degree as Delta against symptomatic infections, but it does still, boosters in particular, do still have protection against severe disease and hospitalizations and deaths in particular. Another concerning thing, a thing that just has set us back, if you will, is that Omicron has severely reduced the effectiveness of the monoclonal antibody therapies that we have been using for the last months. The first two monoclonal antibodies that we had in pretty plentiful supply are ineffective against Omicron. Only one of the monoclonals, called Sotrovimab, retains effectiveness against the Omicron variant, but that is very, very low supply nationally and in Minnesota. This week, we at the Health Department, in consultation with our science advisory team and ethics collaborative, have recommended moving to a random selection process for allocating these very scarce therapy resources among patients who have clinically similar risk, higher risk for bad outcomes. We can certainly talk more about that later if there's time. These are some slides that you've seen before. This just illustrates what happened in London, and it's a little parallel to here. London still was having a pretty substantial Delta wave, but even with that, Omicron overtook Delta in just literally a matter of days, and that's what we're seeing here as well. It's what leads us to, we now estimate, and CDC's estimates are the same, that well over 90% of all of the cases we are seeing in Minnesota now are Omicron, not Delta. Next slide, please. We are tracking, the whole world is tracking, you know, the earliest data out of South Africa and now more data coming out of the United Kingdom and Western Europe. And you can just see here some of the what those findings have been through the end of last year, the degree to which vaccine effectiveness holds after one dose or after longer periods of time, after the second dose and after the booster. And this is against hospitalization. Vaccine effectiveness, so you can see after 2 weeks after a booster, vaccines are 88% effective in reducing hospitalization. So that's very critical and the reason that we are working so hard to encourage folks eligible for boosters to get boosted. As mentioned before, the effectiveness of the vaccine against symptomatic disease is less than with prior variants. this is just a graphic that just shows kind of the comparison of antibody levels that are produced for people with two shots, so fully vaccinated according to that two-shot regimen or the one-shot J&J against the original virus, the earlier strains. You can see that was pretty good antibody levels against the original virus after two shots, and look how much less it is under Omicron. So that's why we're seeing this degree of vaccine breakthroughs. However, because of the antibody levels that aren't sufficient to ward off the infection. But with a booster, that reduced level of protection from Omicron goes up 25 times. So that's where the booster is so valuable against protecting against severe disease, hospitalizations, and deaths. So even though you're seeing a lot of breakthroughs, and I'm sure this is sort of confusing for the public, does not mean the vaccines aren't working and that the boosters aren't effective. They are hugely effective where it really matters in terms of severe illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. The next slide. Our Minnesota story, as you know, I mean, it's kind of amazing, really. Our very first case was identified on December 1st, and here we are about a little under 6 weeks later. And Omicron is rampant across the entire state. Widespread community transmission and very fast growing. Again, 90% of our cases are almost certainly Omicron at this point. And we don't have complete case counts, and we never have. We've always known that what we know through laboratory confirmed cases is part of the picture, but not everyone gets tested. There's a lot of asymptomatic disease that isn't haven't tested, and we don't have those results. But now, with the rapid growth of over-the-counter testing across the world, the country, and here in Minnesota, results of over-the-counter tests are not reported to public health authorities. So as more and more people are relying on over-the-counter testing, if they are positive, we don't have that report. So just a word of caution that the daily case counts that we've all gotten so used to are showing less and less of the true picture. We do anticipate that hospitalizations will continue to follow case increases by some number of weeks. The next slide gets into the very severe impact that this will have and is already having on our healthcare system, which has been under stress for 2 years now. As Madam Chair said at the outset, these healthcare workers have been working incredibly hard for a very, very long time. And this is just adding further stress to an already overtaxed system. Now, with the Omicron wave creating numbers that we haven't seen, we're going to see two, three, maybe four times the number of cases of infection that we have seen in prior waves. Even with a smaller proportion of those cases having severe outcomes and needing hospitalizations, a smaller percentage of a much larger number still means more people needing hospitalization. At the same time, we're in influenza season, and unfortunately, we've got lower vaccination coverage or influenza than we've had in many years. Very unfortunate timing there. And of course, we're beginning to see significant impacts on healthcare worker staffing from their own infections with Omicron or their exposures or their family caregiving or disruptions that happen from childcare and school closures. So it's sort of the perfect storm, an already taxed system, a tsunami of cases, a lower proportion of which, but still net more numbers needing hospitalization at a time when staffing is lower than it has been. And the system is just incredibly, incredibly stressed from this long and arduous marathon that they continue to run on our behalf. Next slide, please. And this just shows you, this is the pandemic since the summer of 2020, the big peak that we saw in the fall of 2020, the smaller spring wave, and then the building of Delta, And then now the exponential increase due to Omicron, and how that you can see pretty much all age groups have experienced the similar patterns, but the proportions of which age group is feeling the greatest impact has changed over time as a result of vaccination coverage in the older populations, in particular. The next slide shows you this epidemiologic curve that we look at, and I find this very helpful because it's so visual, and you can see over the course of the entire pandemic, you know, kind of how things have ebbed and flowed and what the relative size of each peak has been. And here we are now in Omicron, about to surpass our cases, and we really already have surpassed our cases from the fall 2020 peak, and that reporting lag there, those numbers only go up during that lag period. So we are seeing that exponential growth due to Omicron. Next slide, please. Our statewide positivity, you hear about what percentage of tests come back positive. We're now at 19.8% of all tests coming back positive, the highest positivity by a significant degree that we've ever seen throughout the entire pandemic. And this metric is going up about one percentage point a day. In the lag period, we know we're already into the mid 20% test positivity. And this is with very robust testing. We've expanded testing capacity in Minnesota, and Minnesotans are following the advice to get tested if they have symptoms or have been exposed or are just wanting to know, you know, their status so they can take appropriate protective actions. So test positivity isn't because fewer people are testing. It's even in the face of more testing, a higher positivity rate just is another just really good indicator of how much virus there is in the community. Next one, please. This is pretty sobering. This shows you in increments of 100,000 cases, how long it's taken us to reach that milestone. And we're now well over a million laboratory confirmed COVID cases in Minnesota. And you can just see there at the top, it shows how many days did it take us to get to our increments of 100,000. And you can see it took a long time early in the pandemic. And then it took a short time when we were experiencing that fall peak. Then we went into slower growth periods, the Delta wave, compressed that further, but now here we are in Omicron, already 102,000 cases in 17 days. So this will probably be the shortest time yet to get to 100,000 cases. And the next slide shows the time periods that it took to reach increments of 2,000 deaths from COVID in Minnesota. And here too, you can see how that has varied over time. And unfortunately, just in the last month, we've had almost 800 deaths from COVID-19. So here too, I think we may well set a new heartbreaking measure for the quickest amount of time to reach another 2,000 death increment. Very heartbreaking. The next slide. This is a kind of a success story. This shows, as you know, from the beginning of the pandemic, we've been very focused on the vulnerability among congregate care settings, particularly with our elderly, and the impact that immunization has had on reducing long-term care deaths. You can see here, even in as the Omicron wave builds, we are experiencing a much lower mortality rate among the population in long-term care because of the high degree of immunization and good progress on boosters in that population. Next slide, please. So over these last weeks, we have been continuing to say we need to use these layered mitigation strategies. These are things that can help us. Help us as citizens and communities, help our healthcare system by trying to minimize the spread, do what we can to control the spread of this extremely contagious variant. Masking, there's been a lot more conversation about masking lately, and the CDC and we at MDH have updated our guidance to encourage people. Always the issue is to, you know, is to wear masks consistently and correctly, you know, covering mouth and nose, have the mask be well fitting so there aren't big gaps. And now encouraging people to use higher quality masks, N95 or KN95, but also double masking also works. So we have guidance on our website for people around mask usage. And we do think that that, as CDC has been saying for really several months, in areas of high transmission, one of the best things we could do is everybody mask indoors in public settings to help reduce community transmission. Our other mitigation strategies, those things we've been talking about the whole time, remain. There's nothing really different about the mitigation strategy with Omicron. Tool number one and most impactful is getting vaccinated. But now we know the importance of getting boosted as well, getting tested, and absolutely staying home if you have any symptoms. Frankly, at this point in time, with this much Omicron circulating, if you feel symptoms that are consistent with respiratory viruses, you might just assume that you're positive with Omicron and stay home, stay out of circulation while you're waiting for test results, or if you're not getting tested, just isolate with symptoms is the best best thing we can do. Next, and so in summary, you know, this is moving incredibly fast. This is now by far the dominant variant in Minnesota in less than a month. That's the same pattern we've seen elsewhere. No reason to think we would be any different. Much higher rates of transmission, very high and rapidly growing case numbers, even though our case counts are, as I said, increasingly just a part of the picture. Good news is the illness appears to be milder in most people, but just as a factor of sheer numbers, we will continue to see high hospitalizations due to just the sheer volume of cases, and that booster doses really, really do help in improving protection against hospitalization. And I think that may be it. I guess there's one more. And you know, it's good when we keep getting new guidance that additional populations can get boosted, just given the what we know about that impact. We've talked about limited impact of treatments. So for folks who think, well, I don't need to get vaccinated because if I get sick, there's a treatment. I won't have a bad outcome anyway. And that just people need to understand that is not the case in the near term anyway, that these treatments are less effective and those that are effective are in extremely short supply. And as we just keep saying, layered mitigation is the key. It's no one thing is by itself 100% protection, but the more you put these things together, the higher the level of protection for individuals and whole communities. So I know those are not new messages, but we just need people to understand that even though we all are most certainly beyond weary of this, these things still work and are still critical for where we are in these next few critical weeks. So that was really rapid, Madam Chair, but along with you, I'm eager to hear from the frontline workers. So thank you for the time. Happy to answer questions now or later.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Commissioner. We do have a little bit of time right now. I'm hearing some feedback. I don't know, Commissioner, if that's yours. Okay, so we do have a little bit of time now if members have questions. I know a lot of this material isn't new, and I think, Commissioner, you're so right to tell us once again that the mitigation that people are being asked to do is the same. It's just that much more urgent. And I don't know if members have any questions right now for the commissioner. Otherwise, we can go ahead. And Dr. Rice is here. He's our first on our list. So I'm looking for hands, but I'm not seeing any right now. So, okay. So thank you so much again, Commissioner, for you and for your whole agency. And as you very rightly point out, local public health, and everybody who's, you know, working directly and indirectly to try to control the pandemic So thank you very much. So now I'm going to turn to our list of testifiers who've been so gracious to give up their time today and come and talk to us about what they are experiencing on the front lines of the pandemic. And first is Dr. Randy Rice. And Dr. Rice, it's good to see you again. If you would unmute and go ahead and present your testimony. And oh, let me just say to members, what I would like to do now is hold questions until we get through our testifiers. And then, so please, you know, make notes as we go along. And then I think we will have some time for discussion of the what they are presenting. So Dr. Rice, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And thanks to Commissioner Malcolm. We at the Minnesota Medical Association really appreciate all that she and her department's been doing as well, and for the excellent presentation. I'm Randy Rice. I'm a family physician practicing in Moose Lake. As president of the Minnesota Medical Association, I've heard from many colleagues across the state that the challenges and stresses with COVID are real and continue. But today I've been asked to talk about my experiences as a rural family physician who practices both in an outpatient clinic and at the hospital. Some background on Moose Lake. We are 100 miles north of the Twin Cities and 45 miles south of Duluth. Our practice has clinics in Moose Lake, Sandstone, and Hinckley, covering about 20,000 patients over about 50 miles along I-35. We are an independent primary care clinic consisting of 13 physicians, 5 nurse practitioner PAs, and have just under 100 employees. We also work out of the Essentia Health Moose Lake Hospital, which consists of 25 beds. We've probably faced the greatest challenges at the hospital. Nursing and other staff shortages have meant we have been only able to have patients at about half or less of our full bed capacity. We have often been on divert, meaning we cannot accept further admissions. In addition, the hospitals we typically refer to are also on divert. As a result, our ERs are typically waiting 6 hours or more to sometimes a few days to find a place to admit a patient, thereby creating backlogs in the ER of patients waiting for beds. Both in the ER and in the main hospital, this has resulted in patients often being managed locally for problems that are not typically in our scope and much better treated in a tertiary center. For instance, I heard the hospital in Sandstone recently had a patient on a ventilator for 36 hours in the ER, waiting for a bed in a tertiary center ICU to open up, something that would have been unheard of in the past and something we are not typically staffed to manage. We've had patients having to be transferred to Virginia for appendectomies or to Mankato for gallbladder surgeries because no closer resources were available. This is a challenge in taxing on resources, staffing, and emotions, since we are not always able to provide what we would have normally considered optimal care, even as we continue to strive to do the best for our patients. While it obviously taxes our ability to treat COVID patients, it also greatly impacts our ability to properly care for all other conditions, such as heart attacks, strokes, infections, acute surgeries, and many other conditions wholly unrelated to COVID. Our clinic has perhaps fared a bit better than some. While we have often had a couple people out related to COVID illnesses or exposures, we have typically been able to keep services running well. We have learned to adapt using telemedicine, especially phone medicine, to provide services more effectively for those who are sick or trying to minimize public contact. The ability to do this by phone has been essential to our area, where broadband services and individual patient expertise with computers has been difficult or expensive for many of our patients. We have had challenges keeping up with walk-in patients and testing at times due to the large waves of COVID that come through the community. Perhaps one of the biggest problems we've had in the clinic has been the trickle-down effects of COVID on our supplies and testing. Due to disruptions in production and supply due to COVID, we have often been dangerously low on rapid COVID tests now and in the past and looking to the future. And with the appropriate push for increased testing along with decreased supplies, we are not sure how well we can maintain ahead of this demand. Our send-out PCR testing, which remains the gold standard, was down to about a 48-hour turnaround earlier this fall. And it's now taking regularly 3 to 5 days and sometimes over a week, making it hard to stay on top of spread and give people timely advice. Even more worrisome, we are now facing critical supply issues with many other testing supplies, such as simple blood tubes for labs, and are having to consider delaying all but the most necessary tests. This makes for much difficulty in providing quality, timely, and appropriate care for our patients with chronic diseases. we are being told this may not get better for 3 months or more. While perhaps causing less serious infections, the sheer numbers of people now getting the Omicron variant will tax our systems, affecting our clinics, our ERs, our hospitals, and the supply chains. Our ERs are overworked as it is with serious patients, so keeping people well in the first place through vaccines, masking, and other mitigation efforts is critical, but also making sure to have milder cases tested and evaluated in other settings as needed, such as clinics, telemedicine, testing centers, and home testing. While we are seeing breakthrough cases and even hospitalization for COVID in vaccinated patients with both Delta and Omicron, the vast majority of our hospitalized patients remain unvaccinated. Those who get admitted who were vaccinated almost always have shorter and more uneventful stays. Case in point, in our local nursing home where I'm the medical director, this fall we had an outbreak in which I believe we saw about 20 residents test positive for COVID. Of those, most who were vaccinated had little or no symptoms. Most only knew they were positive because they were tested. Of those who were not vaccinated, several of them died. Lastly, our physicians, nurses, and other staff are feeling overworked, underappreciated, and at times abused. While hailed as heroes early in this epidemic, we are now facing arguments, hostility, and even abuse for simply asking about vaccination status. While important that we continue to push recommendations for vaccination, many of us feel hesitant to do so for the pushback, arguments, and time spent seemingly futilely if brought up. I, and I'm sure most of my colleagues, are used to giving advice to patients who do not agree with that advice or refuse to follow it. But rarely has there been the degree of animosity, argument, and rudeness brought on by such large levels of disinformation out there when all we are trying to do is to provide the best advice and care for our patients. I think this is one of the things that is weighing heaviest on our physicians, as well as our nurses and other staff. That, and of course, seeing all the unnecessary hospitalizations and deaths that could be prevented. I thank you very much for your time and for holding these hearings.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rice. That last point you made about, you know, people fighting advice and attacking the messenger is very, very concerning. And thank you very much for being here with us today. Next on our list, we have Rachel Hanneman, registered nurse. Ms. Hanneman, welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time. Please go ahead, introduce yourself, and love to hear what you have to tell us.
Hi, my name is Rachel Hanneman. I'm a registered nurse with Aya Health right now. I've worked night shift for, it's actually 7 out of the last 9 years that I've been a nurse, and the level of fatigue has gone from, we've gone from fatigue to what I would say is despair, and I know that everyone's tired of hearing us say fatigue, but that's, I would say that's probably the territory that we're in now. Thinking about the other pillars of society that are also having the obvious decompensation, the ones that we can see, empty food shelves and altered store hours, delayed and canceled flights. We've just got this rolling tidal wave of school closures. I just imagine what is happening to the industry that you can't see every day. Imagine what's happening to the world where the number one profession is experiencing short staffing and that fatigue that we just keep bringing up. All of the societal stressors of the pandemic that the public are experiencing, we are continuing to experience as healthcare professionals, in addition to the work that we're trying to give, and we're just simply overwhelmed. We don't often eat on our shift because we can't jeopardize our patient survival and our patient's outcome to step away from the floor to do that. We don't often drink because no one wants to remove their masks and risk contamination in order to take a drink on our shift. So we are working 8, 12, 16 hour shifts, and we can't meet our physical needs. We don't always leave at the end of our shift on time, and that just prolongs our discomfort, and we are missing out on that quality time with our families that heals us and restores us. I'd like to shine a little bit of light onto the inside of my current work situation. I was previously a new hire at Hennepin County in their trauma ICU this summer following the closure of my COVID ICU facilities, and I recently had some increased family demands, and my family required more of my attention. I reached out to my employer to see what we could do, and because I was new, I didn't qualify for any of the leaves, anything like FMLA, and my employer had reported having difficulty with their staff remaining compliant when they were in the casual role, meaning staff who work when they're available versus adhering to a schedule. So I was unable to transition into that status after being hired on as a new nurse in an ICU during a pandemic at a time when we are experiencing unheard of staffing shortages. That being the case, I had to resign from the bedside, and I've been working with AYA Healthcare, filling vacancies for the Allina facilities. So that's been helpful, but it bewildered me that that was the conclusion that we had to come to, because we are struggling to staff these beds where patients are coming in unrelenting. The floodgates are just open with these hospitals and admissions, and those patients still rely on hospital level care, and we are grasping at straws on how to fill and provide for that. Working in healthcare right now is reminiscent to me of a project that we did in eighth grade shop class, where everyone was given the same amount of balsa wood, which is the flimsiest, almost foam type of wood, but we were instructed to make a bridge out of it and see whose bridge could hold the most weight before it cracked. We built our bridges, we all took them up there, and we took turns weighing them. The bridges that were the best reinforced, ones that had the best support, never broke at all, and they could hold just a substantial load. Most of those bridges broke. Right now, I feel like we are playing a very dangerous game where we are all reliving that assignment, but instead of with fake fabricated wood, we are using essential workers and essential professions instead of bridges, and we're finding how much pressure they can take before they're willing to break. And is that a lesson that we are willing to learn? And if not, then what's the plan? Thank you.
Ms. Hanneman, thank you so much for sharing with us today. That is a very, very important message for us to hear. Thank you. Next, we have Dr. Craig Daniels. Dr. Daniels, welcome to the committee. And if you would just state your name and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Craig Daniels, and I'm a pulmonologist and critical care specialist at Mayo Clinic. I'm here today on behalf of my colleagues, from healthcare workers like nurses and physicians to social workers and maintenance crews who are supporting safe care for patients during the pandemic. We know the COVID-19 pandemic landscape is evolving and can sometimes be confusing. I recognize there are also differences in opinion on effective response strategies. It is unlikely that we will resolve major disagreement in today's hearing. Rather, I'm here today to share what it's like to work on the front lines of a pandemic right now and to ask for your help. It won't come as a surprise that healthcare workers are struggling. Hospitals are stressed, our staff are exhausted, and the patients keep coming. Why is this happening now? First, we are in a new surge of COVID-19. Omicron may appear milder than previous variants, but it is still a very serious illness, particularly for unvaccinated patients. It is also much more transmissible than previous variants. Thus, while cases may be milder overall, more people are infected. Even a small percentage of a large number of infections requiring hospitalizations puts an enormous strain on the healthcare system. And of course, we're still caring for patients with the Delta variant. Please also understand that treatment evolves as the disease evolves. Some of the treatments that were effective with previous variants don't work as well for Omicron. And the treatments that we have are effective against Omicron are in short supply in most cases. You should not assume you can just take a pill or get an infusion if you get sick. We don't have enough for everyone. Staffing is another concern. Healthcare has faced staffing shortages since before the pandemic. An influx of COVID-19 positive patients presents another infection risk to staff, particularly as Omicron can infect despite vaccination. This exacerbates staff shortages. As staff get infected and must quarantine, we have even fewer people to care for patients as their needs and numbers continue to rise. My organization, Mayo Clinic, has done an exemplary job of managing care throughout the pandemic. And Minnesota is known for its strong healthcare system statewide. But there are hard limits to how far we can push our systems and ourselves, and we are reaching those limits. We need your help. Here's how you can help us. Wear a high-quality surgical mask. Cloth masks are better than nothing, but give highly contagious nature of the Omicron variant, the quality of the mask should be emphasized. If you're feeling sick, please stay home. If you're not already, get vaccinated and get your booster. If you need a COVID-19 test, go to a testing site, not an emergency room. Be kind, not only to healthcare workers, but to each other, because we need to work on this together to get out of it together. Please know that this isn't a lecture or a demand. It's a plea. We aren't telling you, we're asking you. And thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Daniels, for taking the time. And I think that message of be kind is so important. In the people I interact with, my sense right now is that people are very afraid. Even the people who are not working directly with patients, just in general, people are feeling very stressed with everything that's going on. And it's a moment where we need to let our best selves come out, not our worst. So thank you so very much. Next on our list here, we have Kelly Anas, if I'm saying that right, and welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. Hello, everyone, and thanks for your time this afternoon. My name is Kelly Anas, and I'm a nurse in the medical ICU at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis, where I've worked as a nurse for the last 13 years. I'm here today to tell you about my experience working at the bedside in a hospital right now. Welcome to the race to the bottom. First, some context. My hospital is averaging about 90 ill calls a day from nurses who have fallen ill fallen victim to the Omicron variant. At this point in the pandemic, we have rapidly pivoted from too many patients to desperately short on nurses. The patients are still there, but the front line is thinning. Before I started my shifts this past weekend, I was inundated with calls, texts, and emails asking for me to work extra hours, any shift, as many as I want. It's hard to replenish my stores on a day off when I can feel the desperation of my colleagues in the hospital. Needless to say, the anxiety of what I'd be facing when I punched in for my 16-hour shift on Saturday was high. Our stress about what we're facing at work doesn't go away when we leave. I spent the first half of that shift running between my two critically ill patients' rooms. My shifts used to be spent assessing and progressing the plan of care and making changes to what my patients needed based on the time I was able to spend with them. Now, the majority of my shifts are spent putting out fires and keeping my patients from getting worse. Any efforts toward making them better quickly feel like a pipe dream because there just isn't time to give them when we don't have enough trained staff to provide the necessary care. The last 8 hours of my shift, I spent circulating the ICU, helping any nurse I could who was struggling to meet their patients' needs. These duties varied from drawing labs, administering medications, bringing patients to tests, bathing them, and holding the hands of those who are left delirious and scared after weeks on a ventilator and sedation. When I clocked out that night, they were still asking for nurses to stay and help. Having met my 16-hour maximum for the day, I went home defeated. The next day was a 12-hour shift. It was more of the same. Patients being put on ventilators left and right, escorting patients to emergency CT scans. The needs never stop. And neither do the nurses. We are far enough into this pandemic to face the true reality. There isn't any more help coming. But the front line, the only line, still needs support and incentives to keep going. We need those in positions of power to see our humanity, recognize our limits, and fill our cups so we can keep pouring from them. A word on the humanity of nurses. There isn't a person in this virtual room right now who has avoided the trauma the last 2 years have wrought. Nurses have all the same struggles in our day-to-day lives as everyone else, and then we show up to work. Give us ways to test regularly so that our break rooms can be safe spaces again. Help us provide care and distance learning support when our kids are in quarantine so we don't have to leave our coworkers working even more short-staffed. Help us keep the youngest and most vulnerable people in our families from getting sick and putting even further burden on the healthcare system. Scrubs don't make us invincible. Nurses have carried Minnesota on our backs through this pandemic for 21 long months. Stop thanking us for our heroic work and start pushing our hospital leadership to support us so we can rise back up to the standard of care Minnesotans are used to and Minnesota nurses are best qualified to provide. While I'm so grateful for the presence of the travel nurses available to support patient care needs during this time, I cannot stress enough the importance of having Minnesota nurses taking care of Minnesotans. I know I'd rather have the nurse who knows where the supplies are kept, which specialist to page at 2 a.m. and has a rapport with the other members of the medical team. So when nurses raise concerns, they are taken seriously and addressed appropriately. Shuffling nurses around the country by the way of the Nursing Licensure Compact takes away from all of those things. The health system leaders will tell you this will solve all their problems, but it will only create further issues for nurses in Minnesota. Right now, travel nurses are a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, and we need to stop the bleed. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Ms. Annas, and we appreciate your taking time to be here today and appreciate your message. And it does really feel really inadequate to say thank you to the nurses and the physicians and all the other workers who are on the front lines. So thank you so much. Yeah, recognizing the humanity of everyone doing that work. We have Dr. Carolyn McLean with us. Dr. McLean, welcome.
Thank you. So I'm Carolyn McLean, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association. And I am an ER physician both in the Twin Cities and in rural Minnesota. And what I'm going to do today is just take you through a day so you can kind of understand what it feels like to be in the ER. So when I work out in rural Minnesota, it's about a two-hour drive. And this all just happened, so in the past couple weeks. So I was driving out to my site, and we only have two doctors, so I have to get there. And of course, I hit a deer. And so my car, I'm like, I have to get there. There's no one else to work. So my car limps into the hospital parking lot past the guy who's outside every day. He's in a motorized wheelchair pushing a grocery cart saying vaccines are bioterrorism and doctors are trying to kill us. And he's out there every day. And at this point, we just wave to each other. You see him every day. He's out there. So I get into work and we're down a nurse because somebody is sick, which is happening more and more often. And there's already two patients that have been there for at least 18 hours that are intubated, and we are looking for beds throughout the state to find a place to put them. And this hospital does have an ICU, but we can't staff it because we don't have enough well staff. So we have those two critically ill patients, and it takes a lot of work to try to find a place for them to go. Lots and lots of calls, hours of work. Meanwhile, the ER is filled with new patients to see, and there are no more beds in the ER. So I see my first patient in the chapel because that's the only place to see a patient. So as you see these, you know, one patient after another. Some are COVID, but this is the time of year when patients die. So it's in the end of December, beginning of January, just because people eat too much over Christmas and they want to make it till Christmas. This is a time of year where patients are really sick in general. So when you add to that the mental health crisis where everybody's sad, there's a lot more people that have anxiety and depression that are coming to the ER on top of your normally really sick patients, and then you have COVID. And in the rural areas, there's not as good of vaccine coverage. So the rural population hasn't been vaccinated. So they tend to get sicker. And even if that means they're not getting admitted, they still come in. And especially with Omicron, and this is just my experience, but what I've seen is that it seems to be a lot more gastroenteritis, so a lot of diarrhea and vomiting, and they need IV fluids, and they come in and they get their electrolytes replaced and they do okay. But that's still a lot of people coming into the ER looking for that. And then there's all the primary care doctors and clinics and urgent cares that can't staff. So patients can't, they don't have any place to follow up. So they end up back in the ER. So we have incredibly high volumes with a huge number of sick calls. So it's really challenging. And then you have the challenge of patients with COVID when they haven't been vaccinated and they are sick and they might die. They're in this place where they haven't trusted the healthcare system enough to get vaccinated. And you really want them to trust you, because if you're critically ill, you want your patient to believe that you're going to do everything you can to get them better. So that requires more time so that you make sure that they feel like they're getting the care they need. And then the other part that's been really hard lately is, unlike in previous waves of the pandemic, is it seems to be a younger group that's getting sick and dying. And it's hard to see parents with young kids that are going to be on a ventilator and then go to the ICU. And maybe not be able to work, if they survive, maybe not be able to work for months in recovery. And then there's, you know, I had this patient yesterday who, she was 25 and she hadn't got vaccinated because she was worried about her fertility and she really wanted a baby. And she came in yesterday with vaginal bleeding and COVID. And then she miscarried and she was like, should I have gotten the shot? And you just go, at that point, I don't know. You don't know. But I just feel so bad for these patients who don't, they don't know where to go to get trusted advice. And that has been probably the hardest thing for all of us as nurses and doctors and techs in the front line to, where normally we have to have trust based on you're an ER doctor, not on I know you, Dr. McLean, because they've never met me. So that lack of trust requires a lot of work to get back. And it's super important. And it's I think that's one of the hardest pieces right now that's really making us all stressed out on this. But I will say that I have never seen anybody, any group of people come together to work so hard and help each other out. And we have been in the ERs I work in, people are super supportive of each other. And that's been really nice. So thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. McLean, thank you so much for walking us through what your day looks like. And, you know, I think you make a very, very important point about the undermining of trust in our medical institutions. And this is something I don't think we've really seen before to this degree. And I certainly hope that it doesn't survive the pandemic, so to speak. You know, it's really concerning. So thank you for being here. And then we have Mary Turner. Welcome to the committee, and thank you so much for taking time to be here with us today.
Yes, thank you, Chair Liebling. First of all, I'd like to, I'm president of Minnesota Nurses Association, but I always say more importantly, I'm a COVID ICU nurse on the night shift at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. And I would like to first thank all the other frontline healthcare workers that spoke today. I don't want to, you know, be redundant in anything that they hit on, because Dr. Rice and Dr. McLean hit on the rural aspect. Kelly hit on the metro aspect. I think I'll dive just a little bit into what is going on since, you know, the end of February 2020 on my unit. It was, you know, I still remember that day I got off the elevator and the young nurse came up to me, Nurse Blair came to me and said, Mary, is it true that we get one N95 to wear till it disintegrates off our faces? I see some people, I see Dr. McLean smiling. That's what we were dealing with. And it was okay to wear one N95 for 10 full shifts. And so that whole first year, we were dealing with doing very dangerous work because we knew so little about the COVID with so very little protection. But the thing was, is we had more staff back then. People weren't disillusioned. We had enough respiratory therapists. We had enough doctors and nurses. And this was even before there were cures. And everybody seemed to pull together. And society wasn't quite bored and tired yet with the pandemic like they all seem to be now. Now we go where we've got the vaccine, and like everyone else has said on this line, most of the people that come into my ICU, and we're a 13-bed unit, most of them are unvaccinated. Sure, we have the breakthrough cases, but like I tell people, the people that are come to my ICU, they're the type of people who have so many other comorbidities that if they got the regular flu, they would end up in my ICU. Okay, so that's the one thing to tell people is that, yeah, maybe the vaccinated are getting it, but the ones who get seriously ill, a lot of it's due to they have a whole laundry list of diagnoses, and they would be at risk no matter what. But the things that we're having to put up with now, somebody had mentioned, I'm going to mention it, the increased violence and workplace violence that we are having to deal with. Because, you know, a year ago, you didn't have to sit. Well, first of all, families couldn't come in. But when they did, they didn't sit and argue with you. They didn't sit and get into political debates with you. Okay, now we're putting up with, you know, people would rather do essential oils than to do medicine. They got to argue with you for every single thing. And a lot of it turns violent. I had a nurse not too long ago on one of the med-surg units. I asked her how her day was. Do you know what she said to me? She goes, I had a good day. I wasn't hit. I was dumbfounded. I have the privilege as the president of Minnesota Nurses to do a little bit of circulating around the state. And I was up in Duluth not too long ago. And I'm going to bring up another concern. And when I went to St. Luke's and I was standing by the elevators and I had one young nurse come up to me and she pulled me aside. She was literally crying on my shoulder. She says, Mary, I've only been a nurse for 2 years and I don't know if I can keep doing this. Guys, that is huge. That is huge. When we've got our young nurses, and it doesn't matter that they've got average of $70,000 worth of student loans to pay. They're telling me that after 2 years, they want to get out of the profession. Right there is a crisis. All these nurses that started nursing, well, I don't know about the doctors, but they can address that. All these nurses who started nursing during the pandemic, we are at risk of losing. And so our employers, our governor, our governments, our employers, we have got to do better. We've got to do better. And you know, I was just on another committee meeting with the workers' comp people, pleading for PTSD recognition. You know, presumptibility for nurses. We have nurses that are committing suicide. We have you know, somebody, you know, we have people that come around that, you know, it used to be in an ICU. It's nothing to have an occasional person die in an ICU. But since this pandemic and the pace has increased, it is nothing to have 2 to 3 deaths per shift. Do you know, outside of, you know, our morgue in our ICU, in our hospital carries about, what, 6 beds or 6 people, whatever. And less than a month ago, we got a big, huge refrigerator semi, just like they did in New York. Within a week or two, that thing is full of dead bodies. And that means on my floor, at any given time, the nurses are dealing with 2 to 3 deaths a shift. And there's none of this, oh, can we debrief and all this other kind of stuff? No, it's like, quick, get the body out, get it to the semi so we can clean the room and get another one of those 60 people that are sitting down in triage and those 15 people that are waiting for an ICU bed. So there is no time to debrief. There's no time to hold each other's hands. There's no time to grieve. And I fear what will happen to our profession when we get done with this pandemic. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Turner. It really almost leaves me speechless, which is pretty rare for me. But honestly, I just hardly know what to say. It is just, you know, this is, you know, the needs of human beings who are taking care of other human beings. It is just really overwhelming. And I could see here, we can all hear the emotion in your voice as you explain to us what is going on and what this is all meaning on the front lines. And so thank you very, very much for being willing to relive it to the degree that you can tell us about it, because even, you know, this is so hard, so hard. So, So everybody has been very concise in your presentations, and although every single one has been very, very impactful, I want to give members a chance to ask some questions. We do have some time, and I see that Representative Hewitt has his hand up. So, Representative Hewitt, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the testifiers. This was definitely a moving day for many of us, I'm sure. Kelly, I can't say your last name, but I love your meme, your tape. It really puts people where they're at. What is the bed ratio, patient-to-patient ratio right now in the ICU at Abbott, for nurse to patient?
In the intensive care unit? Oh, honest.
Honest.
I always say it's like honest, but without the T at the end.
Ooh, I like that.
In the ICU where I work, it's currently a max of 2 patients per nurse. Where that gets a little bit trickier is that we're often pairing up, or nurses are often taking 2 patient assignments that would have normally been 1-to-1 nurse to patient assignments, but because of the lack of staff, they are 2 patients to 1. And that's any shift in the ICU. And then on the med surge floors, telemetry floors, mental health, day shift can be anywhere from 3 to 5 patients. Night shift can be as high as 7.
And a follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt? Yep.
With that, you also have an aide that probably has 3 nurses assigned to that person, or is that right? So you have your whole nursing staff that is totally being overworked right now. You can just shake your head yes, and then I'll continue with the last part of this. Mm-hmm. I really like what you said, and we need answers. It's more than the question, right? I have a medical background. I worked in the ER and stuff like that, and it always amazed me on Christmas Eve when my family's at home and I'm working the ER, and here comes administration with the cookies. We can't give you cookies. It's just not what you need right now, and I want to know what you need. And this has been the hardest question I've asked every healthcare provider. As legislators, what can we bring to the table for you? I like what you said about daycare and making sure that when you're focused at work, that we're helping you focus the family at home. I would like to try to get more information from you and your team on where can we go? What can we do to make sure that through this time that we're giving all medical staff the resources they need to do good work, what you're doing, and also be comfortable that your family is safe at home. So thank you for those suggestions, and I invite you to please send us more. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Ms. Annas, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I've had enough pizza in the last 2 years for the rest of my life, so I appreciate that acknowledgement. Knowing that my family is taken care of at home. My husband went to 4 different stores the last week looking for masks, like surgical grade masks for our 5-year-old door to preschool. Knowing that our families have the PPE to wear when they have to be out and about in the community so that they don't get sick and I can keep coming to work. Having tests available, home tests, so that I don't have to hold my 2-year-old down in the pediatrician's office every single time he gets symptomatic or exposed to daycare. And I know that those are a lot of the things that come up for the nurses right now. I think we're also feeling that the scariest place to be in the hospital is the break room with each other, if we get a break. I ate in the locker room the other day because it was where I could be alone with a mask off, because I am so afraid to catch this virus and bring it home to my 2-year-old who's too young to get vaccinated. And just anything that we can do to continue to protect ourselves and the ones we love so that we can keep showing up for the rest of Minnesota.
Thank you. And I see that Ms. Hanneman has her hand up, and I want to give her a chance if she wanted to weigh in on this as well.
Regarding some of those ideas, one of the thoughts that I had mulling around in my mind is I feel like we have a backlog of patients in our hospital that could potentially be receiving rehab care and TCU level care, but there's nowhere to send them. So we have those patients that are boarding down in the ER who need hospital level care while beds are filled with dischargeable patients, but there's nowhere to send them to. So maybe we need to start looking at ways that we can filter those patients out and get hospital patients in the hospital, rehab patients into rehab. We have the National Guard who's helping out. Is there something that we could do to make sure resources are trickling down? Because those facilities are also having some struggle. So we're not the only ones that are short-staffed. It's everywhere that we are taking care of patients. So maybe just spreading resources out and looking at the whole picture would be helpful.
Okay, thank you so much. Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. And I thank you, Representative Hewitt, because actually you answered one of my questions in what we could do to help you and maybe help create a safer environment in those break rooms and those spaces where you have an opportunity to decompress for a minute. And obviously, you know, keep thinking on what that might be and how we can help as a community or as legislators and send those suggestions our way. And I want to speak to something a little bit more. We've kind of touched on it in small ways today, but I'll start with a statement and then ask my question. So I think we all know that most folks who go into the medical profession are nurses, are doctors. You know, I can tell you I'm the daughter of a nurse, 43 years at Hennepin County in the ICU. And the nurses that I know, they are an incredibly unique group of individuals. These are people with extraordinary heart, who have an extraordinary capacity to really deeply, deeply care for their patients on a fundamental and humane level that is beyond comprehension to me in some regards. I've seen it in my own mother. And when we're talking to nurses here who are already incredibly sensitive to the needs of other humans, and they're telling us that not only are they seeing the pain of losing a patient, that's hard anytime it happens. But right here, we're talking about losing as Mary mentioned, 2 to 3 times a shift, and not having the mental capacity to be able to decompress from that, to be able to reconnect as humans. And I'm really concerned about the level of burnout. I'm really concerned about the level of PTSD, and I'm extremely concerned about our loss of those young nurses. And I guess Mary alluded a little bit to the possibility of making sure that we are making sure our nurses have coverage for PTSD. But I guess I'm wondering more about the mental health impact of our nurses, where we're at with that. Are we seeing more and more nurses leaving the profession because they are just at a place where they just can't do it anymore? And what can we do to help make sure that we're easing that some of that burden, I guess, is my question.
All right. So Representative Bonner, I see that Mary Turner has her hand up, and I don't know if she wanted to respond to this particular question, or go ahead, Ms. Turner.
Well, yeah, thank you. I mean, as far as what you are alluding to with our PTSD is, you know, in my other committee, 96% of us nurses have some PTSD. Roughly 21% can be clinically diagnosed with it. 1 in 3 nurses are experiencing burnout and moral injury. So if that helps you as far as, yes, it's very real what we're dealing with. I did want to, Representative Hewitt, you had asked what the ratios were at North Memorial. It's getting more and more. We're 3 patient assignments in the ICU. And these are 3 vented patients. Okay. And our night shifts are having on the med-surg are having 8 patients. We're in crisis staffing now. Why I wanted to get on here, though, is you're asking for solutions. There's one thing I think can come from the government is there any way we can cut down the paperwork? Seriously, guys, it's all hands on deck. And these 2 hands, they cannot be sitting on a computer. They need to be on the patients. And I've been in this profession since I was 12 years old. I swear to God, I started as a candy striper and then a nursing assistant. And I have seen the amount of paperwork and all this other stuff just increase and whether it's because of insurance companies or whatever, or everybody wanting to have more and more documentation to justify getting the bills paid. But right now is not the time. So if there's any way that we, and I don't know if it's federal or who is responsible for it, but we need a decrease in our paperwork and all of those kind of obligations. It just doesn't make any sense to me right now. And maybe that's very naive, but you wanted some suggestions. Take away all right.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. You know, I think one of the things that this kind of points us to is that we have a very complicated, convoluted healthcare system. And when we have this kind of crisis, it doesn't lend itself to focusing on the things that matter, because we have so many extraneous things that aren't really healthcare in our system, right? But, you know, I would like to, and I see that Ms. Sales has her hand up. I would like to, you know, I think that our purpose today is not to go deeply into solutions. I hope that we'll have a lot of offline conversations about potential solutions as we go forward into the legislative session. So this is definitely not the last discussion we will be having, but I really appreciate, and I know other members are really appreciating kind of hearing the what's happening on the ground piece, because, you know, that's what we hope to do in the legislative session is be put forward and work on some real solutions. And we're getting there. Unfortunately, legislatures don't work that fast. I know the governor is trying to do some things immediately, but, you know, we need to get all hands on deck and try to work in ways that not only help us urgently, but also help us going into the future. Ms. Sales, let me call on you, and then I'll go to Representative Bolden and Representative Morrison. Go ahead.
Just Ms. really Sales. Quickly, Laura Sales, I'm a lobbyist with the Minnesota Nurses Association. Just wanted to say that we do have solutions that we're putting together and that we will be bringing to you and having conversations with you about. So you'll be hearing from us.
Great. Thank you so much. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it surely is not adequate in the least to say thank you for it.
And Representative Bolden, we're having a little trouble with your sound. Are you plugged in all the way?
Maybe come back to me. Apologies.
Okay. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Boy, this has been a powerful hearing, and I first just want to express my gratitude to Commissioner Malcolm and everyone at MDH for their ongoing steadfast leadership and hard work through this seemingly unending pandemic. We just owe so much to them. And thank you to the testifiers for taking the time to be here and for taking care of Minnesotans through this. You know, it's been referenced a couple of times that healthcare workers were heroes in March of 2020, and we've kind of devolved into something different. But it's hard to adequately express gratitude for the people who are on literally the front lines. I think that we're seeing conditions that you'd expect to see in the developing world or in wartime in our hospitals. And you heard Mary Turner reference the moral injury that nurses and doctors are suffering. And that is not an exaggeration. I wish we could put this entire hearing on every local news channel so that all Minnesotans could hear the words of our healthcare providers here today. I thought Rachel said it really well when she said, you know, there are the visible changes where, you know, we're seeing canceled flights and fewer staff in coffee shops and of course, staffing elsewhere. But unless you or a family member has been ill and hospitalized, unless you have a reason to be in one of our hospitals, that is invisible to the rest of us. So many of us are continuing to go through life pretending that this pandemic is over, and it is not. I thought that was such an important point to be made. So I guess I want to reiterate Dr. Daniels' wonderful list, and he called it a plea. He asked people to please wear quality masks, particularly when you're in indoor public spaces. Stay home if you don't feel well. Get vaccinated. We've heard again and again this afternoon that getting vaccinated and getting your booster is our best defense against this virus to protect ourselves and to protect these heroic healthcare workers that we're hearing from today. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, be kind to each other. And I love that. I wrote this down. He said, this isn't a lecture. It's not a demand. It's a plea. So my gratitude to every one of you for being here today and for the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. I agree. I wish every Minnesotan could hear these stories. I think it could possibly make a difference. I'm going to go to Dr. McLean. I don't know if she wanted to comment on this, but please go ahead, and then I'll go back to Representative Bolden.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that one of the things that can be helpful to all of us who are, you know, all of our nurses are working double shifts. We have to do jobs that we normally don't have to do. It would be great if we had some legal protections, because it's really challenging and we will all do our best, but it would help if we could have some protections during this time, especially over the next couple months when things are going to get a lot worse.
Okay, thank you, Dr. McLean. I'm going to go back to Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me now?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. So as has been said, it truly is not enough to say thank you, but I do want to extend my sincere thanks to all the testifiers on the call today for both the work that you are doing and continue to do in extremely challenging, difficult, just words can't even describe times, as well as being here today to share your stories and your truth. because I imagine it is difficult to do that. It's not an easy thing to sort of relive that and sort of in your time away from it to have to retell these stories. And so thank you for that. I think it is important to have a window into this, especially for, you know, for folks, as has been said, for folks who aren't living it and seeing it every day. You know, some folks are sort of going about their lives like we're in normal times, and we clearly are not. So thank you for sharing your stories. I've been a registered nurse for almost 20 years, and I know a lot of nurses. They are the best people I know. Nurses are amazing. And similar to, you know, what Rep Bonner has said, you know, we come to this profession, we come to this work because we care about people, because we want to care for people. And, you know, in this time when that is what you all want to do, you want to do your very best to care for people, and you can't do the work that you want to do. You can't do that to the degree that you want to do. I just want to underscore again the moral injury, moral distress that you all have been facing and continue to live through is significant. I want people across the state to recognize that and just see that, again, to have a window into that, both from not being able to, you know, have the resources, the staffing right now, that there's just not enough of you to be able to give the care that you want to give, to day after day, you know, care for patients who die. And just the grief and the trauma and the weight that carries, the violence that you're seeing with patients and families. I think that's just important to recognize as well, and call that out, and to be aware of, you know, sort of the some of the causes of that, and you know, the disinformation that is out there fuels that as well. And I think that there's a place, a role for us as legislators to, you know, to play in that and to put out good information. And so just thank you again for what you're doing and for sharing your stories, and would reiterate, you know, the items that have been shared that we can all do to help you, those five things that have been shared that you know, at the very least, those are the things that we can do. So thank you again.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just hope that you can have a placeholder during our future meetings for looking at ways to help with efficiency and effectiveness. I know for a long time, long-term care facilities have had to have their nursing staff do duplicative paperwork and et cetera, maybe leveraging the state to have a portal that makes that more efficient, but also look at ways that we can help facilitate certain things. You know, we've talked before about pharmacogenomics and others, of where helping get the correct care to the individual patient first and fastest. So just, you know, future scheduling, it'd be nice if we could address this general issue. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Look forward to seeing the bill on that, how we can possibly reduce paperwork. I mean, I think we all agree we want to be as efficient as possible. Sometimes it's easier said than done, given the complicated duplicative system that we have, but I'd love to see the bill. Absolutely.
Madam Chair,
yeah,
I had had some discussions with people about some of the portals that the state has with the different entities, and they were updating that. And I will see if we can come up with something that'll help facilitate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. And of course, you know, would love to hear from you and talk with you about that as well offline. Let's see, we do have a few more minutes here that we could entertain a few final comments or questions. I don't see any hands, but I will just say then that I am so appreciative of all of you who have come here and shared with us today and your perspectives. And really, I can hardly remember a hearing that has had as much impact as this one. And I just hope that Minnesotans can listen to this, if there's media watching this, please, please carry these stories. And I know that this wouldn't be the first time. It's not as though we don't hear about these things, but the way all of you have expressed this today and the impact of, you know, what is happening now in this worst point so far, which we know, we heard the numbers, we saw the graphs at the beginning of this hearing, and you know, you're bringing it here with this very human dimension. I mean, we could go on and on. We haven't heard today from patients or families of patients. We know that more and more of us are personally acquainted with people who have been very ill or have died. And, you know, that is this is becoming a much more common phenomenon among our population, that we all have family or know somebody or have ourselves been sick. So there are lots and lots more stories that could be told. But I think that for us to understand what's going on with those of you who carry the burden in such a direct way, and in addition to what I think Ms. Annas has expressed so well, that you're all carrying the same burden that everyone else is, in addition to your work burdens that are so incredibly heavy. So we just want to express our heartfelt thanks, although obviously it seems so trite and so inadequate to say that. But really, we appreciate your time today. We appreciate your commitment to Minnesotans, to getting through this, your willingness to keep carrying the message, even when it feels like people don't want to hear it. We all want to hear everyone say that it's done, that we can go back out and meet in person and have a good time and not wear a mask. And none of us wants to do these things, but we know we have to. We know we have to band together. We know we have to be kind to each other. And kindness in this context, one of the big things it means is doing our part, wearing that mask, getting that vaccination, staying home, all of those things, so that our neighbors can be healthier and that you who are on the front lines will be, have your burden lessened even a little bit. So we look forward to working on solutions that we can, things that we can do from the legislature. We look forward to working on those solutions throughout our coming legislative session. And we always welcome everyone to contact us, contact the legislators on this committee, contact me for sure, and let us know, you know, what you see as ways that we can help us all get through this, and for sure recognize your humanity, Ms. Annas. I think that is just so meaningful for you to be reminding us that you carry all those burdens too, as a mom of a young person, and you know, that image of, you know, fill our cup, I think is so important. So with that, members, thank you all, and look forward to seeing you again soon. We are adjourned.